Welcome to The Point. I'm Steve Junker, in for Mindy Todd. We are continuing our series of visits to area libraries. Today we are at the Osterville Village Library. Are you a fan of Osterville Library? Do you have special memories from here or programs that you love that happen here? We want to hear from you. You can call us at 866-999-4626 or email thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joining me is Cindy Cotton, the Library Executive Director. Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having us.
Oh, thank you so much for being here.
We are set up in the entrance. We're right next to the circulation desk. The library doors have just been unlocked for the day. It's 9 a.m. People are coming in. There's already people here.
Yes, there are. We have Mahjong starting an instructional class. We have a children's author going on at 10, so there's a lot happening this morning.
Now, your library is, in a lot of ways, it's just as much a community center as a library. There is a quiet room for people who want that kind of space, but there's explain some of the other things that are happening here. A lot of activities going on.
Yes, there are. We have a business center, so people is a co-working center where people can work and talk on their phones and video conference. We have the McGraw Atrium, which is great for social engagement, all the different groups, the Mahjong, Canasta, rug hooking, there's just tutoring. There's so many events there. We have a Zoom room on the lower level, which is our quiet space where people can do telehealth or video interviews and have privacy in the soundproof booth. And we have a quiet area. And then we have other rooms that people meet and have conversations or different types of meetings.
It's not a problem that we're talking right here in the entranceway because this is not necessarily a quiet type library.
No, not the main level is not quiet because, one, I have a very big mouth. So my first day here, I was shushed. And then so we had to rearrange things.
You were telling me that you just had a blood drive upstairs here.
Yes, we have the Red Cross at least once a month. We brought them in during the pandemic when other places were shutting down. So we've had that relationship going. It's very important. There's a huge need always. And we're very happy to host them at least once or twice a month. It's 3 years now.
Tell us a little bit about the building itself. Describe it for folks who haven't been to the Osterville Library. And it's an enormous space and a beautiful space, a lot of light.
Yes, it's 22,000 square feet. We've been in this new building 12 years. It is beautifully designed and very open and bright, as you say. There's spaces for quiet, intimate meetings. There's elegant, beautiful rooms. There's a fun and active and inviting children's room. There's quiet spaces. There's just really something for everyone. And there's a main meeting room that can hold up to 100 people, and then a small boardroom off of that. So we have a lot of space. And then we have a beautiful lawn next door with a gazebo and just a beautiful area to just run around and have a picnic.
I want to ask you a little bit more about some of the spaces and how they're used by the community. Tell us a little bit about, you took me into a co-working space, and it's not just an empty room for people to come into. It has a lot of facilities ready for people to use.
Right. We have Fios Comcast, and we also have OpenCape. So we have redundancy on connectivity. In that room, we also have a HIPAA 3-level shredder, so if somebody's an entrepreneur and they're making this great invention, they can shred it afterwards if they need to. We have a large format printer, copier, up to tabloid, along with fax scanning and scanning to email. So there's a lot of services there, and people can talk on their phones and bring in food and bring their dogs. So we're very opening space that way for the business center, which is right off the front of the building and easy access to get in and out of.
And how much use does a space like that get?
It gets quite a bit. We have a gentleman that's in there every day. We have, some people that are here who are with their families that need to get out of the house to work, and they work. There's always somebody in there doing something usually, and more than some to multiple people. And then if there's a power outage, it's jammed.
Okay, because you do have a generator, right? So even when the power goes down, you have internet access for people who need it or power for people
and heat and air conditioning, depending on the season. And we'll stay open, we'll accommodate, and yes, we're full service.
Okay, so on top of all these many things, and we're going to talk about them a little bit more, but you are just a library, too. We have
books.
A big lending collection here of books and DVDs and all kinds of things, too.
Yes, we have books, DVDs, audiobooks. We have a library of things where you can check out anything from a sewing machine to a metal detector to musical instruments to yard games, puzzles, games. In the kids' room, you can check out a dollhouse, a fire station. There's all these kits. There's really something for everybody in how they want to learn or play or engage. Our children's room is like a window and a mirror. You should see yourself, but then it should be a window to take you to where you want to go and learn.
Mm. You have something that I'm not sure any other library on the Cape has on the front sidewalk outside the library. It's a 24-hour vending machine of books where people can check out books and maybe DVDs too.
Yes, books, DVDs, and children's books.
Describe this for us.
It's really cool. So if anybody's familiar with the Red Box, it's similar to that, but it holds 250 books. And then you can look through and select and pick and read more about the book that you'd like. And then you select it, and the machine goes through its thing, which is fun to watch. And the kids love checking out books. And then you take your book, close the door, and off you go. You see it's like a 10-second from picking your book to going, and eventually would like to put holds and different things like that in there that people. But it gives people 24/7 access to materials, children's books, DVDs, so with a clams card.
Yeah, I was going to say, you show up with your clams card, yep. You scan it in there, and then
you
get to choose from among these more than 200 items
bucks,
that are
yep.
in there. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's great.
Does it get a lot of use?
Yes, because accessibility is very important to us. That, you know, people that work, you know, traditional 9 to 5 hours, they may not be able to get to the library. You're coming down, you have kids, something, you know, a Sunday morning, you need a DVD for a child, you can run up here and get it. You know, you need a beach read or something like that, you can come grab it, or after 5 and get another book. So it is great.
We are at the Osterville Village Library. I'm Steve Junker in for Mindy Todd. We are speaking with Library Executive Director Cindy Cotton. You can join our conversation right now. Give us a call at 866-999-4626 or email thepoint@capeandislands.org. Cindy, tell us a little bit about the Library of Things and what these are. Not books that people can check out, but objects, but a lot of really interesting stuff here.
Right. We have a lot of the traditional things you can check out, but some of the more unusual things you can check out is, like, if your car light comes on, we have the car light reader, so you can see what's wrong with your car before you maybe take it to a dealership. The metal detectors are a lot of fun. We've had people use those when the kids visit to go look for treasures, or people sometimes are looking for property lines or different things like that, or lost wedding rings. There's a guitar, a drum kit, a ukulele for instruments. I believe this.
We're standing here looking at the shelves, but you were telling me that the shelves are actually
fairly empty, bare.
Yeah,
there's
to,
a sewing machine that's out. There's croquet. There's bocce. There's volleyball. There's ring toss. There's all sorts of summer games. There's all the puzzles and games. There's probably 60 different games that you can check out. So if you're people visiting, you don't have to buy a lot of things. You can just come check them out. So there's really all sorts of wonderful things that you can also find the complete list on our website, OstervilleVillageLibrary.org.
Now, you also, as people come in the entranceway, you've got a display set up, and you also have a kind of a big tabletop or a countertop area where you have all the different events that are happening. And there are so many events that and activities that you guys have sort of presenting to the community, I guess.
Yes, we're very fortunate. This Friday, we have the Flying Dogs as the kickoff to the summer reading program for the Town of Barnstable Libraries. So that's exciting. We have Monday, we have a 45-foot whale that you can go inside and learn about these beautiful creatures. And they just saw a blue whale off
A 45-foot whale, like a big inflatable
yep.
whale?
Yeah. Yep. We have Patrick Ahern coming as an author. We have a Osterville Historical Walk. We have 6 concerts this summer. The Moonlighters will be here this Thursday from 6 to 7. We have a talk about the Kennedy, Jacqueline Kennedy's wedding. We have an author's montage.
A lot happening.
Yeah, and Hydrangea Festival this weekend. And it's like,
what is the Hydrangea Festival?
That's where people generously open up their beautiful yards and allow people to tour and see their hydrangeas. And we have 5 houses available on the tour this summer.
Okay. If people can hear a dog, is that what we're hearing? Tell us about the 2. There's, when I came in this morning, 2 dogs greeted.
Yes. Dewey Decimal is the latest employee at the Osterville Library. He's all of 2.2 pounds, and he's a poodle, and he's full grown, and he has quite the vocal cords. But he likes to see kids who are being tutored, and, you know, he's the reward afterwards, and a lot of people come to see him. And then there's Mazel, who is his older brother, who's been coming here for like 7 years now.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here. You're listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker in for Mindy Todd. We're at the Osterville Village Library visiting with Library Executive Director Cindy Cotton. When we come back, we've got a visit to the Centerville Historical Museum. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker, in for Mindy Todd. Today we're broadcasting live from the Osterville Library. Just down the road is one of the Cape's hidden gems, the Centerville Historical Museum. The museum has something of an unassuming exterior, but don't let that fool you. It houses extensive collections and exhibits. Mindy Todd took a tour last month with the museum's director, Randall H. Hole. The tour began with the exhibit of historical clothing and textiles. Let's listen.
The Centerville Museum has been here since 1955. It was originally started with a group of ladies who started the Historical Society, and they, in turn, were able to capture the original house, and they went around to the neighborhood and all of the old families and collected material, photographs, information about the families, and that's what the base was for the museum. And we started in 55 with about 1,000 pieces in the collection. Today we have over 18,000.
Wow. And when you say pieces, this is from...
Like this is one piece, two piece, three piece, articles, okay. Objects.
So, and how far back do some of these outfits go?
Right. Well, our collection goes from about the earliest piece is about 1680. Oh. It's a woman's petticoat, and we also have a corset from that time. And then a fair amount in the 18th century, but the bulk of the collection is the 19th century.
And are all of these articles from Cape Cod?
A lot of them are, but what had happened is over the years... We became known for our costume collection, which is our primary collection. And people would come to various exhibits, like this one, for instance, and they would say, oh, my grandmother has a dress just like that. Are you interested in seeing my great-grandmother? You know, that's how it grew. So we had started with, I think, about 150 costumes. Mm-hmm. There was a collection given to us by Dorothy Waterhouse. She was one of the founders. And she had about 250 costumes in her collection. And then she had a close friend who was the curator at the Rhode Island School of Design Museum. So they had offered us and given us probably another 400 or 500 pieces. And then from there, it's just grown and grown. And, you know, so I don't know. I mean, our wedding gowns alone, we have about 150.
And these look like they're in remarkable condition. I mean, looking at this purple outfit, which is still very vivid and bright, they don't look like they're... So did you have to restore them? Did they come?
That's a good question, because the collection gets evaluated all the time. We just go around and around and around. And it's not just clothing. It's photography. It's furniture. It's all kinds of things. But so everything gets evaluated and assessed for its condition. And then we started a program back in 2020 where we hit... We're able to capture two very professional clothing conservators. So they decided to join as a volunteer. And then we were able to get teams of four each. So other people joined joined the group who were sewists. That's what you call them. They're sewists. And so under the leadership of this one person, they sort of showed them and walked them through the various processes of restoration. So, for instance, just textiles is what they work with. They don't work with any paper or anything else. So there's probably about 280 pieces that need to be looked at or attended to. And as I said, they vary in their condition. If it's really too poor, we don't do anything to it. But a good example is this costume right here, capelet. It's made of silk. Silk and beads and silk thread. It's from the 1880s, and the silk thread was dyed with a very caustic dye, which rots over time. So when we were going through this, one of the times we evaluated, the beads were falling off because the silk was rotting. So we brought it to one of the group, and that she said, yes, I can reattach the beads. Well, she reattached every bead. Every single bead.
A lot of work.
Took her over a year.
Oh, my goodness.
But it's been completely restrung with contemporary non-caustic dyed silk.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is. And that's a very good example of how this piece will be forever in a wonderful condition. Another example is a wedding dress from the 1924, rather. Silk fractures, been dyed, like I said, and it'll break. Mm-hmm. And so this piece here... was breaking in various places around the dress. Now, for us, that's a significant wedding dress for a couple reasons. We know the family it came from. It has a great provenance. And we also know that, I mean, it's a wonderful style of the 1920s.
It looks very 1920s.
And it's a wedding dress. Yeah. So that was completely restored. We purchased the right silk, right weight, right color, and right texture, and then replaced the... It's mostly in the back. You can't see it. I can spin it, but it looks exactly like the front. Yeah. So, but that's a good example of what they do.
I'm noticing the shoes, and especially some of these older shoes. Like these are 1920s. Well, it's 1912, 1925. I'm not sure what the shoes are, but obviously they've been polished and shined to look like they're, yeah.
Yeah, actually the shoes are, again, a reflection of the costumes. They reflect two different periods. One would be the turn of the century, and the other would be the 1920s. So typically the button hooks, that was the 1900, and then this pair is probably from 1925.
You got to do a lot of dancing in the 1920s.
Yeah, absolutely. And the same is with the shoes down there, too. But, I mean, the whole point of this exhibit is to show that very distinct and radical stylistic change that happened over a very short period. And the only time that fashion changed that quickly in America was in the 1960s. By the 1920s, women were going to college, women were taking on jobs, women had their own money, women had a lot of say in what their lives were going to be like, and the fashion changed according to their interest and according to their convenience.
Mm-hmm. I notice you mentioned Coco Chanel here on your plaque, yeah. Who, of course,
is one of the remarkable women fashion designers of the time. The museum has 14 exhibit areas, and so we try to feature different parts of the collection in different parts of the room. So this particular part of the museum is the original house, which was built in 1855. And it came into possession as a museum in 1952. Then they spent 3 years trying to get everything together and restored and so forth, and then that opened its doors in 1955. Mm-hmm. So, and this is the original parlor, and it's...
Is the furniture original?
Everything in the collection is original.
Wow. Oh, the kitchen.
Yeah, the kitchen. Okay, so speaking about original, kitchen's a reproduction. So this is a colonial kitchen which would never have been attached to a Greek Revival house like this. But the original kitchen was in really rough shape, so they decided to dismantle it. And there was a house in Barnstable that had a kitchen that they disassembled and brought back here and reassembled. So it's made to look like a colonial kitchen, even though it would never have been attached to the house, this kind of house. But part of the reason they did that was because there's a large collection of colonial cookware, colonial furniture, colonial pottery, that we had in the collection, and it just goes well in that room. And every dress in here is from that period as well.
You really feel like you're in the past.
Well, that's history museums try to do that. You know, that's part of our mission. So this is the kitchen. We changed this out too. It just happened to have gone back to a colonial theme. The exhibit that was in here before was a speakeasy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we can actually transform this room enough so that it doesn't even look colonial. Yeah, it's kind of fun.
We make our way from the kitchen into the parlor, where two women and a man are costumed in period pieces.
This is also a room that changes. We have volunteers that do a lot of this, and they decide on the topic, and then we go through the collection and see how we can express that topic. So this topic is on courtship. And so the idea is that the costumes are all from the mid-19th century. There's explanations in writing everywhere for people to read about what the ceremonies were, what were the traditions, what were the things that they did then that would never happen today. And part of the interesting thing about doing this is that it always gives people an opportunity to reflect on how different today is from then.
Yeah. I mean, give us an example of...
Okay, an example is when a man was courting a woman, they were not allowed to touch each other. Not allowed to touch each other at all.
Not even shaking hands.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good example.
Yeah.
And also a man would give a gift to a woman. It had to be a certain kind of gift because if it had to be a gift that had no strings attached to it. And that was very important. So it had to be very benign. So it was those kind of protocols that we express and explain in this exhibit here.
Mr. and Mrs. Thomas A. Gilbert.
Right. These are calling cards, so which was very, very common at the time. You'd go and visit somebody and you'd leave their card so they would know you're there.
We leave the parlor and head to the back staircase.
Very skinny stairs. Was this like an attic or it just, this
no,
is
this
just...
This was the part of the original house. So her father built the house in the 1850s. He and his wife stayed here. She was born. She lived with them until they died. And then she lived here until she died. She never married, and she kept bees and raised chickens and that kind of stuff. But this would have been her parents' room, and then it would have become hers. And we just converted it into exhibits.
Yeah.
So in here is an exhibit on Paisley fashion.
And Paisley fashion, which has been fashionable for many different decades. Right?
Oh, absolutely. It's been definitely very fashionable. It actually originated in the 11th century, came out of India. And it was it migrated to Europe, and the Europeans tried to copy the pattern, and they couldn't do it. And it wasn't until the 19th century, Queen Victoria got infatuated with it. She had several shawls, and then that's inspired a lot of people to really figure out how to make these things.
Interesting in this room, though, you've got so many different time periods here. Like, I'm looking at that two-piece Paisley bathing suit, which says screams 1960s to me. And then some of this looks very old.
Well, yeah, it actually, some of the pieces are 1850, and then we try to run it all the way through to something as modern as these times.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So we're just showing how it's held up over time and some of its different styles and types. But something that's worth noting is that there was a very clever textile manufacturer in Scotland who discovered and figured out how to make Paisley fabric. And the town that textile mill came from was called Paisley.
Oh.
Hence, that's where the name comes from.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
We move from the front bedroom and the Paisley exhibit to an upstairs room at the back of the house.
Oh, Hollywood comes to Centerville.
Yeah, this is an exhibit that we feature a Hollywood notable that actually lived here and brought a lot of his Hollywood friends. So they had, it was sort of like Centerville's little 15 seconds of fame, if you like. But his name was Herbert Kalamus, and he's the man that developed Technicolor.
Oh.
And his wife, Natalie. And they lived in this house, which is right down the street. And that was their summer house. And so the first two films that he made that actually were successful in Technicolor were Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. Hence, that's why we have those two up.
And the Ruby Slippers.
Yes, the Ruby Slippers. Not original.
I
did say almost everything on exhibit is original, but there are some things that we fake.
Yeah.
That's one of them. And this is another one. This is Bonnie Blue. She was the little girl in Gone with the Wind. She acted alongside Clark Gable.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's a picture of her from the actual film.
Right, yeah.
So we had one of our sewers duplicate this
costume,
so that's not original either.
And then on the other side, you get movies that are filmed on Cape Cod.
Yes, these are just sort of featured films that a lot of people recognize that were filmed. Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, Hyannis, Bourne, there's just various towns where Chatham.
How long have you been the director here?
18 years.
So you've learned a lot over that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I've forgotten almost more than I've learned.
We make our way back down the stairs, and we walk down the hall past displays of items and framed artifacts.
This just features a notable Centerville family, the Marston family. And this genealogy is their family. These are things that came from their restaurants, which were in Boston. This deals with, this is the menu from his restaurant. He had three of them. And these are all in cents.
Oh, my goodness. What year was that?
1849.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, so let's see what we have here. Boiled chicken and oyster, 21 cents.
Not a bad deal.
Another area of the museum displays enlarged vintage photographs and scrapbooks.
Just another taking another theme and trying to put it into a historical context, of which we had taken photo albums and brought them out and showed these are family albums, family treasures, and how people had gone to the trouble to create an environment for their photographs that indicated how precious this was. And you can see, like, with these tooled leather photo albums, and there's that's velvet over there, and the mirror inset, and it was just a way of preserving their family visual heritage, and they just got passed down from generation to generation.
I think it's interesting you've got sort of an history here of, yes, of photograph albums, but why don't people smile in the 19th century photographs?
Well, it's always a question that people want to know, and we explain why.
Sealed lips were an effort to conceal one's teeth or lack of them.
Right.
People didn't smile that much in life. Nature gave lips to conceal teeth. Flashing a big old toothy grin was seen as classless.
Yeah. I think one of the other important things to consider, too, is that the technology of the photograph was in its beginnings. So in the 1860s, it would take a long time to have an open exposure in order to have it burn onto a plate. And that would take sometimes up to a minute. And so you couldn't move.
Right.
And if you're sitting there smiling, your smile would eventually droop and it would get blurry. So, and as you move forward in time with the advancement in photo technology, that time frame started dropping down to like a second and then less than a second. And by the 1890s, much faster shutter speeds. And these are just photos that we pulled out of the albums and then blew them up so you could get a sense of how they thought they were important.
Are these Valentines up here?
Well, actually, these are scrapbooks, which scrapbooking has been around for a long time. And in this case, these belong to certain families that were here in Centerville, and we brought them out and put them up just to show a glimpse into what these people found interesting to put into a scrapbook. There's something that's really important to keep in mind with scrapbooks is that in the 1870s, 80s, chromolithography was developed, which was the first time color printing became popular, and hence people went crazy.
Yeah. They're really beautiful. I mean, they're like works of art.
They are. They're very interesting because the consumer was all of a sudden enamored with a color image. It didn't matter what it was. So in this scrapbook, there's advertisements, there's drawings and paintings of little girls, there's a bucket of, it's just very discursive with what they're using, but it's the color that really fascinated them. Not unlike what happened to my generation, when color TV came into being. I don't know how to describe it. It was remarkable.
You just think back to The Wizard of Oz, which we talked about earlier, where everything's black and white, and then you land in Munchkin land.
Yeah. And that's what happened with these people. So these sort of reflect that. They reflect their current interests. This person, they were obviously interested in some kind of interior design, so they cut out. And this is also one that's completely black and white, which dates it before these other ones.
At this point, we head into the basement of the museum, marveling at the exhibit space that is housed in this historic building, which appears so unassuming from the street. We enter a space with colorful prints.
Japanese woodblocks. They are a collection that we have. They're all mid-19th century. Most of them are just tales, folklore tales, depictions of famous historical events. Depictions of famous historical people, which was typically what they did in the mid-19th century in Japan. We discussed all about how it's made, the history of them, how they came about, and they're really very quite colorful.
Yeah.
What's very interesting about this particular art form was to express everyday life in Japan. Yeah, it's called ukiyo-e, but it's pictures of the floating world, or it's actually pictures of the common world, or its translation. In America, you're probably familiar with the name Currier and Ives.
Mm-hmm.
They were exactly the same thing.
Oh, okay.
It was color, which chromolithography came into being, and this, of course, was color that came on the scene in Japan. It displays different events that are common to their culture, as did Currier and Ives. People's skating on ponds or sledding through the snow. I mean, there's hundreds of Currier and Ives prints.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because they both had the same topic of their own culture and they both came into being at the same time. And they were both mass-produced.
Now, this is Japan. We're on Cape Cod. Did this come from a Cape Cod collection?
I did, yeah. Somebody who had collected it had given it to the museum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We move past the Japanese wood prints into a large room filled with military artifacts.
This looks interesting.
This is an exhibit of World War I. We have quite a few pieces in our collection that are about World War I, so we had created this exhibit to express and explain some of the important events that happened during the war. There's a timeline up there that explains the major battles and what the events were that caused them. We talk about weapons. We display helmets and uniforms and talk about espionage and just basically cover a lot of the highlights of World War I, of which we also feature. Not only is it a global topic, but we bring it down to somebody that lived right here in Centerville. As a matter of fact, and this person here lived in Osterville. And the woman over there who was a nurse, she's from Osterville. These are her papers. These are her passport. And these are the places that she served on the Western Front.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, quite a bit.
I have Matahari.
Matahari, yeah, that's a great story, absolutely. And then, of course, some of the intelligence that was really important at the time. One of the things that we like pointing out is that the radio communication had become wireless, so it was really easy to intercept everybody's communication, which didn't make it very easy to tell secrets over the air. But the U.S. had drafted, for lack of a better word, the Choctaw Indians, because they spoke a language that no one in the world could understand.
Oh, they're called code talkers.
They're called the other code talkers.
Wow.
So they were integrated into the service, and so when they were moving troops or they needed to communicate back and forth secrets or things that you didn't want the enemy to find out about, these are the ones who did it. All these other languages, European languages, everybody knew them. And this is an exhibit we have on shipwrecks, Cape Cod shipwrecks, you know. Can't go without it.
The Portland.
Yeah, the Portland. Everybody went down with the ship. It left Boston, and there was a storm coming, and it headed to Portland. And when it was last seen, or almost the second last time it was seen, was off of Gloucester. And then it was stuck in the storm for 2 days. And then it was last seen off of Provincetown in the Selwagen Bay area. And then it went down, and yeah, the ship's wheel. Yeah.
It floated ashore. It's wood.
Yeah, that's it. That came off this ship. Yeah, it's actually cool, but it's also kind of sad because
very sad,
these
yeah.
are all the people that were on the ship.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Yeah, quite a few of them.
So everything that's on exhibit now, this will be through the summer?
It'll be through this year, right. Yeah.
Through the whole year?
Through the rest of the year. In December, we close until mid-January, and then we start January, February, March, we start changing out all the rooms, not at once, but one at a time.
And when do you start planning that?
Oh, now? Yeah, definitely we try to get it done as much as possible because it's just a lot of planning involved. Just as something as simple as we change the color in the rooms. So we have to figure out who's going to be around to paint it and when it's going to be done. And then there's things like these boards, the written information. People have to research it, have to check it, have to edit it. And then these things get printed and that, you know, we want them to match the colors, you know, there's all that kind of design element that goes into these exhibits. And then there's just the physical articles. How are we going to display them? Where are we going to display them? You know, so all that has to get sort of worked out as you go.
I'm thinking back to the Colonial Kitchen, which you said was a speakeasy before.
Right.
Where do these ideas come from? Do you start looking at what you have in the collection? Is it volunteers who goes, hey, we know we have this?
It's part of that. That's part of it. That's a lot of it, actually. It's just coming up with ideas that are kind of unique. Coordinate them to something that's significant, you know, and of course there's a long history of exhibits that have already been done here, so we'll go back 10 years, 15 years to make sure we hadn't already done that.
No, there's no harm in doing it again. If you did it 15 years ago.
right. I mean, for example, after this one comes down, there's talk of making it World War II because we have quite a few uniforms, quite a few articles and so forth that are from World War II. The jury's still out on that, you know. Who knows?
We'll have to check in with you next year, right?
From the basement, we head to the final exhibit. It's a large open space on the second floor with a number of wooden desks and a wood-burning stove in the corner.
It looks like a schoolroom.
It's a schoolroom. Across the street was where the 3rd Centerville School was. It was built in 1880, and a lot of these pieces came from over there. So this is kind of a thing that's set up that explains what school life was like.
A whole new meaning to the tablet, right? These are like little chalkboards.
That's a great observation. Yeah, that's right. These chalkboards are your early tablet. Absolutely. I've never made that connection. That's a great idea. But that's what this is. And we have the kids that do come in, and we sit them down, and we pull out those chalkboards for them. We have them practice their alphabet and that kind of stuff. But it basically explains what life was like, the rules in the schools, the punishments for misbehavior, which gets a lot of rise out of people.
Let's go look at the punishments for misbehavior. This should be interesting. Oh, here's teachers' rules, punishments, students' rules. A rap on the hands or knuckles with a steel-edged ruler. Oh, my goodness. Oh, there's a lot of punishments here. Oh, look at this. Teachers' rules, 1872. Women teachers who marry or engage in unseemly conduct will be dismissed.
Yeah. Well, it was a different time.
Yeah.
It's the way it was. And I think that's part of the thing about history that's very important is you don't try to change it. You don't try to gloss over it. You just say that's the way it was. We don't need to apologize.
We don't have to judge. Yeah,
we don't have to judge. Right. You know, absolutely. Because it brought us to where we are today and so on and so on.
There's such a wide range of different topics in here, in this, and as you're saying, changing all the time. When people come through here, what do you hear most? What's the reaction?
Well, the one that you had. This is a lot bigger than I thought. Yeah, I mean, that's really, really common.
And a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, and there's a lot of cool stuff. That's true, too. Yeah, we try to make it interesting.
That was the director of the Centerville Historical Museum, Randall H. Hole, with Mindy Todd. We will post pictures of our visit along with a link to the museum at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Steve Junker. We are live at the Osterville Village Library. We will have more after a break. Stay with us. You are listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker, in for Mindy Todd. We are live this morning at the Osterville Village Library with the library's executive director, Cindy Cotton. Listeners, are you a fan of the Osterville Library? Do you have a special memory from here or programs that you love that happen here? We want to hear from you. You can call us right now and join the conversation, 866-999-4626. Or email thepoint@capeandislands.org. Cindy, we're standing here in the entryway next to the circulation desk. People are coming in and out, and there's an event happening right now in the children's room. Tell us a little bit about what's happening.
Well, this morning we have a story time with author Kim Clarkson, and we are featuring each Wednesday at 10 a author story time, and they're local authors, and there's a craft, and it's just a wonderful way to expose children to new books and new genres and meet with other children.
Now, your children's room has a lot of children's books, but it has a lot of other stuff going on in there too. Tell us a little bit about some of the things that go along with the books that are in there. There's books that read to you. There's books that do all kinds of things.
Yeah, our children's room is amazing, and we like to say there's a lot of on-demand programming for people, so you don't need to come at a specific time. There's always something to do. For toddlers, there's a train set, there's a huge dream house, there's a spaceship, there's huge Legos that they can play with. There's kits. We have books that'll read to you and read along with you. They're called Wonder Books that are amazing. We have virtual and augmented reality books that you can read and then put your phone in the Google Glasses, and it'll take you to the moon or the fish, or you can use the augmented reality to have them swimming around your house. We have books that are called Playaways that will read to you through the headset. Mm. We have tablets that don't require internet access that can help you with story time and reading and word recognition and things like that. We have all sorts of different ways for children to read and to find their way that is best for them to get information, whether it's hands-on creating or listening or reading or a combination of the two.
There's such a cute scene going on right now. The children's room is full of kids and some parents and maybe grandparents too, all getting ready for the story hour that's going to happen. You were telling me about why you feel it's so important to have so many different, they're not books, but so many different things for children to do and to ways for them to access educational materials. Explain what the thinking is behind that.
Well, it's very important that people find the way that's best for them to learn. Not everybody can just sit and read and comprehend. I personally listen to books, and that's how I get my information. Other people can read. We also have hands-on kits, and these things are also good to foster conversation with grandparents or non-custodial caregivers and things like that, so they can start a conversation with the children by doing something. You think this should go here? Should we put this color here? How can we do this to make it work? So all the things that we have are a different way of maybe trying to reach and help a child see what their best ability is and make them feel good about how they learn.
Right outside the library here, right adjacent to it, there's this lovely park area. It hosts a variety of events. I know when Mindy visited a couple of weeks ago, you had a group of folks enjoying a plein air painting class out there. Tell us a little bit about the space that's outdoors that's part of the library, too.
It's beautiful. We have a huge lot next door to us, and it's has an amazing gazebo on it that we host 6 concerts during the summer. The Moonlighters will be here this Thursday, and we have country music, Brazilian music, big band jazz music. We have all sorts of things. We have the kickoff to the summer reading program Friday. We have a 45-foot whale. We have a plein air Paint the Village art show on the 20th with 24 artists and the village crafters. We have the 50th annual road race that'll be out there. We have so many things. You just need to almost go to the website and check it out.
And you were telling me, too, that the lawn next to the library is served by Wi-Fi as well. So people can just come and sit at one of the tables or along the benches and do their work outside.
Yep, they can. We have that totally Wi-Fi'd.
The library hosts a number of changing exhibits. And tell us a little bit about that. What goes on here in that way?
Well, we have a lot. Like right now, upstairs, we have Mark Person, who is a photographer, and he has an amazing exhibit of black and white and color photography. On the main level, we have Bonnie, and she does the ceramic whales, which are spectacular. And she's actually sold quite a few while they've been here because the exhibit is so special.
It's almost like a little art gallery right in the middle of the library as you walk in, just off to one side.
We always rotate the different art and different styles of artwork. We've had stained glass, we've had mosaics, we've had all sorts of different things. So every couple months we rotate.
I think people listening must be wondering, their definition of a library is different here, and very intentionally so.
Well, you know, after the pandemic, people suffered social isolation, and on the Cape, there's a lot of single people, and having that social interaction is very important. Having that place where you can go and people, you know, are glad to see you, or if you haven't shown up for a few days, we're, you know, looking for you, and to have social groups that meet here. We have so many different groups that meet here and other nonprofits that it's just really, you know, a great community thing. And they come in with their dogs, get a treat, and get a book, and off they go.
What was it like for you going through the pandemic as the library?
Well, we had to shut down during the mandated time for the 2.5 months, but we reopened right at the first possible time and by following all the guidelines. And it was very difficult at times being the mass police and people dealing with people with different levels of mental challenges and things like that. But we did it. We're very proud of the fact that we did it. And it was a great asset to the community for the people to have something that was somewhat normal and have access to books. And plus they had to find out ways to print their beach stickers and their dump stickers, and everything went online. And they couldn't deal with that. And then when the vaccines, we had a lot of older people that didn't have computers, and then we couldn't get them because they didn't have email addresses. So there was a lot of things that we could support people with, and then getting into information and providing trustworthy information about what's going on in the village and the town through our YouTube channel.
Even as we're standing here, somebody came in looking to print something, and you're quick to be able to, you know, explain how they can easily do that by sending something on their phone, and people come in to play canasta and mahjong. It's a lot going on here. You also have this really cool space in the basement called the Maker Space. Is that what it is?
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
That's a lot of fun. We have 2 Oculus Rifts virtual reality where we have things of social and...
These are the headsets people can put on.
And they can go to the moon. They can go up in Apollo 11. They can learn about the 1968 race riots. They can go to the Anne Frank House. They can go down to the Titanic and actually come back up. They can go to the space center. They can climb Mount Everest. So there's many different things that people can do. that they maybe physically or financially can't do. So it's a wonderful experience. And we also have a 3D printer, so if somebody has an SDL file, they can email it to us and we can print it, or they can print it here. We have a green screen. We do astronomy at Dowsett's Beach in the fall. So there's a lot of different things. And it's like a training center. We have computers and things like that down there.
Mm. Take a step back and explain for us what it takes to keep a library like this running.
Yes. We are not a town-funded library, which is a misconception. We are a private nonprofit, as all the Barnstable libraries are. We do get a grant from the town, but my job is also to raise $900,000 a year, and I'm also building our endowment to help sustain us into the future. So we have lots of different fundraisers that are going on, like the two cars that you saw out front that somebody could...
Tell us about the car raffle. <Go ahead.
laughs> So somebody has a chance to drive away in their choice of either a Jeep Wagoneer or a Jeep Wrangler, rather, or a Audi Q3. And that drawing is on August 24th, and that is a big fundraiser for us. We're very lucky to get both cars from Premier. We do buy the winning car, but they generously let us use them out here for the several months. We have all sorts of different fundraisers that Experience Austerville book. We have the road race coming up. We have the Paint the Village. We have so many different fundraisers throughout the year.
So your job, you're the executive director here. It's entirely different from being like a head librarian. You're running a really big operation here.
Yes, yes. And it's a dream. It's a dream job. It's a lot of fun. It's so much fun to create something that's this wonderful with a great group of people that I have here, and to have something that people want to donate to and actually come to me to give us money because they love what we're doing.
One of the things you were telling me about is your YouTube channel. Explain to us why a library has a YouTube channel and what people can find there.
Well, it started, again, out of the pandemic where we were providing information. I was interviewing, like, the town councilor and the fire chief and police chief and things like that to make this information available to people. And then, you know, accessibility. We make all our programs, unless there's a copyright issue, available by in-person Zoom, or they can see it on our YouTube channel after. So it's grown throughout, and people look for it. And we have, like, the village association meetings, and, you know, if there's things going on in the village, whether it's the wind or the save the wind or not save the wind, we record both sides and make those available so people have information. We are in the information business, and we try to always provide the latest and best.
Mm. Mindy told me that I should ask you about a robot librarian that you have.
Temmie has a vacation day today.
So he's not here operating right now.
No, but he can go around. He can tell you, like, where the children's room is, where the atrium is, where the new books are, what the library hours are, bring you to our YouTube channel, and things like that. He's the kids love him. He'll tell story time. He can tell bad jokes. But he's a lot of fun.
There's so much technology involved in the library these days.
Yes, and it doesn't always work at the same time, which is, you know, gets frustrating. But, you know, we do our best.
We have just about 30 seconds left. Anybody who thinks that libraries are obsolete or going obsolete should stop by here. It's just amazing all the things you have going on.
Right. Libraries are not obsolete. We could be open 24 hours a day and be busy. It's just a great place for people to come and you're always welcome.
Cindy Cotton is the executive director of the Austerville Village Library. Cindy, thank you so much for having us.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
Big thank you to Dan Treidel back at the CAI studios for engineering our show today. In Austerville, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Treidel. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.